Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with the Paranormal Report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley and Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
The call had come in early that morning, and we found ourselves on the road again. The details weren't very clear. All we knew was that someone had shot someone with a gun. The man who met us out front of the poorly maintained apartment building was the manager. He wore the sullen look on his face like a mask. We followed him up the blood-stained stairs to the unit at the top. He unlocked the door and stepped aside. If walls could only talk, these would be screaming. The living room wall led immediately into the hallway and was heavily sprayed with blood. In the middle of it all was the only clean space, and it was a clear outline of a body. Crimson spatter and sickly pink brain matter covered the walls and ceiling. What happened? I didn't think a scene like this could get any worse. I learned I was wrong again. This is the cleaning of John Doe.
Objection.
How's my questioning out of line?
Yes, your question's out of line.
How is my questioning out of line?
Because...
Objection is a thing. Counselors, please approach the bench.
And counselor, you would have known that your line of questioning was out of order if you had listened to the Judge and Jury podcast on judgeandjurypod.com, also available on iTunes and Stitcher. Now return to your tables and listen before I find you in contempt of court. Go!
Welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW, 1150 AM Seattle Alternative Talk Radio. I'm Al Warren, and over there's Kev Thompson.
Hey, Al, how are you?
Now, don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter under the handle Radio Cub, Facebook, we're House of Mystery, and our website is somethingweirdmedia.com. Now, today, we're covering one of the oldest FBI cold case files ever. Now, can you guess what that is today, Kevin?
Oh, my God. Yes. Well, it's unfair because I already know, but I have looked so forward to this interview. Tons of questions, Kevin.
Yeah. No, Kevin, it's not your mother. No.
Oh. Well, that's disappointing.
Today, Kevin, we are hunting Hitler. Well, no, not us, but we have a guest that has, and will continue to, we hope. And what we're talking about is we have a guest, Mike Simpson, who is from the series Hunting Hitler, found on the History Channel, and they've just wrapped up season 2. And thank you very much for being on the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure to have you and take you away from your busy schedule. And so let's start out with what brought you to going and doing the show Hunting Hitler?
Well, actually, I made it to the show by my friendship basically with Tim Kennedy. Of course, Tim and I, very similar backgrounds in a lot of respects, and Tim and I were both Special Forces, both in the same Special Forces group, although different generations. We had a lot of mutual friends, mutual acquaintances, people that we'd served with, and Tim and I like to tell people Tim and I had the longest running friendship ever, with actually only ever being in the same room together for about an hour or so, because we had a lot of telephone conversations, a lot of texts, a lot of emails, a lot of going back and forth on stuff, and then when, after Tim, of course, did season one, which is what initially got me really interested in it, word went out that they were looking for another Special Forces guy to be kind of Tim's counterpart, like the European version of Tim, only what it ended up being is a European version of Tim in a shorter, older, pudgier fashion, which ended up being me. And Tim put it out there. He said, we're looking for a Special Forces guy, but not just a Special Forces guy. We're looking for the following qualifications. And some of it had to do with language. Some of it had to do with very specific training that not everybody in the Special Operations community gets. And I read what he posted. He posted it actually on a social media page. And I said, well, I fit all of these. So I sent him a text rather than a reply. I said, what's up? I said, I check all those blocks. And he said, yeah, email me your resume. And so I did. And then I got an email back from the production company, and we did some interviews through them, and they asked me, you know, what I knew about the first season, what I thought I could bring to the table, and there was, of course, a vetting process between myself and a lot of candidates. Really shocking. If people only knew how many people have tried to be a part of this team, just the fact that I was even considered, I thought was a huge honor, and then to make the final cut and to end up as a part of the investigative team was huge. So, and eventually they did notify me, yeah, we whittled it down, and you're going to be our guy. We're sending you a plane ticket, so you know, get your bags packed.
Oh, that was incredible, because I know that Tim Kennedy has done a lot of good work. Now, when they asked you about your qualifications, you know, you're going to be on the show hunting Hitler. Did you have to know the history, or did you have to already have pre-knowledge of the investigation of itself?
Knowing basically what had gone on in season one, just to have an idea of what the scope of the investigation was important. But it was not important for me to be, say, you know, a history buff. And as is evident in the show, obviously they paired me with one of the most world-renowned historians on that time period that's out there, James Holland. So me knowing the history was not as important as my background in military intelligence, my background in reconnaissance, my background in tracking drug lords, in tracking terrorists, and having been involved in manhunts in the past.
You know, that's a – boy, you really bring up a really, really good point. I've watched the show, and I never really thought about it that way. You already had a ton of skills to already bring to the table. They supply the history, but you do all the footwork.
Exactly. And that's what they want. They don't want, you know, they don't want all kinds of eggs from the same basket. They want that contrast, and they want fresh eyes on it, which they think is really important. I mean, they've done an amazing job of building this investigative team, and their approach, kind of to the point counterpoint, you know, teaming a historian such as James Holland with myself or with Lenny DePaul, U.S. Marshal, teaming a well-known journalist, Gerard Williams, with Tim and with myself, teaming me with Graham Woods, people that come from different backgrounds. So we're constantly approaching this investigation through different lenses, and that I think is what gives us that introspection and gives us those fresh eyes to open up this cold case and really see it through the lens of 21st century investigative capabilities and find these new leads.
Because you guys cross some rugged, rugged terrain.
Absolutely, we do. And there were certainly some days where I definitely felt that the bills were paid in what we did. The one in particular that always sticks in my mind, when we filmed at the monastery in Spain, which was incredibly breathtaking views, But when we had to go and investigate the cave system that's there, there was a lot of footwork on trail just to get there that they cut out, which was quite beautiful, but obviously for the brevity of television was cut out. And there was quite a bit more cave exploration that we conducted that eventually didn't make it into the final cut. But that was a day that I definitely returned, you know, 2 days of filming, I returned to my room just exhausted and covered in sweat. That was one. And then the other was the second day, which you saw of me crawling through the abandoned sewer system at the hotel in Spain. And that's those clothes, by the way, are in a landfill in Spain somewhere. I did not bring those back. definitely was in some spots and covering some terrain that if it had been somebody who just a week before had been working in a library somewhere researching only books, physically, I don't think they would have been able to handle it.
That's true. It's not always for the academics. Now, one more question, then I'm going to turn it over to Al real quick. Well, actually, it's more of a comment. You know, we were talking about rugged terrain, and you mentioned a monastery. One of my favorite episodes, and I really, really had to respect you guys for this, is when you guys found the aqueduct and the foundation in Argentina. You guys had to trek through the forest.
Right, and that was, of course, I was on the European team for that leg, but just hearing the guys that were there were when I linked up with them in South America were still talking about basically everything they had gone through to that. And we try to minimize, you know, for this show, I don't know if it comes across, but we really do try to minimize what I call the tooth to tail ratio on what we're doing. So, I mean, we really are packing everything in and out, and as much as possible, of course, you know, the crew is trying to catch all this in real time and really do an accurate portrayal of how we're doing everything, and they're having to minimize what they carry as well and kind of lug everything in. But at the end of the day, we're all a team, so we're all looking out for one another. And, you know, there are times that I've had to reach out in a pinch when there is a cameraman or a sound guy on a precipice who is so caught up in doing his job and being caught in the moment of the scene that the real hazards that might be just to their left and right sometimes get shut out, and they really are putting their safety at risk quite a few times to film the show, because again, whenever possible, they're right there with us.
And that's where your expertise comes in.
Certainly, yeah, and certainly they definitely let me know it was appreciated.
Was this everything you expected it to be?
I get asked that a lot, and I got asked that the first time after my first day on the job in Spain, and I really didn't know what to expect. Never having been a part of anything like this before, quite like this. I mean, you know, I've been in semi-permissible and non-permissible environments where I'm doing things in a capacity as a member of the Special Operations community, where I'm doing this type of thing, you know, trying to uncover these facts, trying to get to the bottom of things, but it's a little bit different. You know, at the end of the day, I'm either returning to a safe house or whatever it might be, not kind of going along with the cameras there to witness everything. So, I went into it ready for anything and not really knowing what to expect. So I have to say that one thing that I had no idea of was how incredibly professional and really quasi-military the team would be. Spending 32 years of my life in the military and the bulk of that in special operations, I was just blown away by how incredibly professional the crew was, how everybody had a job, knew their job, did their job in an amazing fashion. You know, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do, you know, hopefully we're going to get this. The unknown is always there because it is an investigation. And there were times we went places and we talked to people and spent hours there and got literally nothing from it. There are multiple interviews and multiple areas that we went to that never made it to the screen because, you know, they were either dead ends or we got what we needed somewhere else. But
there's a lot of people still silent. I mean, there's still a lot of people scared to talk about Hitler.
There are, and particularly one of the when I joined on for the South American leg, that's when I really started to see that a little bit more. And there were two interviews in particular that I was involved in that did not make it. One of which, just because they were so evasive, I had basically already determined the answers to the questions I was going to ask them, and it was more for confirmation, but they were so evasive that it ended up not being worthy of making it to the final cut. There was another in which basically the person we were talking to ended up being not who they were portraying themselves to be, and I determined that during the course of my interrogation, and I basically started treating them as I guess you'd say, as like a hostile witness, which probably wouldn't have played too well, and that actually ended with me looking at the crew and saying, I think we're done here, and just walking out, and that didn't end up, although it probably would have made for some dramatic television, we really didn't get anything worthwhile out of that interview. So,
what's the fear of Hitler? Like, on these days, this is so long ago. Why aren't people able to open up and just, he was here, or he did this, or why are they so guarded? Like, what do they have to fear by talking to you?
Well, have you ever seen the movie with Denzel Washington, Inside Man?
I think so.
It's a movie. Denzel Washington and Clive Owen. Basically, the premise of it is that there's a very rich New York banker who owns a lot of buildings in New York, has been in the banking industry since he came over from Europe in the 1950s, and basically he's hiding a lot of old Nazi treasure, and that's what he built his empire on. There are a number of people, particularly in South America, who have estates, who have farmland, who have entire communities, and that was built on Nazi plunder, and they're still protecting that. If the repatriation of those monies was ever really pursued, then you would be looking at people losing large chunks of land, losing family estates, losing a lot of their wealth. And there are still people down there with things to hide, some of which are still living. They might have been very young at the time that they fled the falling Third Reich, but some of them are still alive. And those that aren't have passed on to their family members these things. And they stand to lose quite a bit if this were ever exposed. And even if it's not monetary, they stand to be held up in front of their community as something that they have portrayed themselves as not being, and that would damage their reputation quite a bit.
So what was your belief when you came into it as far as Hitler? Did you have the theory in your own mind that he didn't die in the bunker?
When I went into watching season one, I will say that I was pretty skeptical. Of course, I know Tim, and I know Tim to be a man of honor. I know he would not be a part of anything that wasn't on the up and up. And, of course, since he was a friend of mine, I was going to watch the first season. But really within the first 15 minutes of the first episode of season one, when I realized so many of the things that I had been taught in the history books were inaccurate, then I was on board, really, from that point. And I started to do some of my own research. Albeit not on the level that I did as part of the investigative team, but really seeing that we were fed something that was convenient for the time. That's in order to close that chapter in American history, the boogeyman had to be dead. We needed that closure as a nation to move on with the rest of the latter half of the 20th century, and we weren't told everything. And in season one, episode one, there's a line where John says, if somebody tried to file a life insurance policy for Adolf Hitler, it would be denied because there is not enough proof of his death. And that was certainly true in season one. And of course, season one, as I've said before, opened up a Pandora's box because as it was viewed around the world, people started to come forward. Files started to get unlocked in other countries. And it's gone from an FBI cold case to a worldwide investigation. We're talking about intelligence pools from multiple agencies crossing multiple borders over decades.
Well, Mike, you just opened my Pandora's box of questions, so I'm going to try to be careful with them.
Okay.
Now, a couple of times so far, you've mentioned an FBI cold case.
Mm-hmm.
We were told, I'm saying we as America, we were told that Adolf Hitler killed himself in the bunker.
Yes.
And, you know, here's pictures of the body. Here's Eva Braun. Here's some of his other, you know, soldiers with him, for lack of better terms. And then the Soviets immediately take the body and burn it. That's where I begin to get suspicious. However, if America's official line is Hitler is dead, he committed suicide, why would the FBI have a cold case? Well, what's cold about it?
Well, if you look, certainly the statement is made, and the famous headline. Hitler found dead. Hitler found dead in his bunker, or found dead in Berlin, which you can see. I believe there was also a Time magazine cover with a red X across his face, much like the Time magazine cover just a few years ago when Osama bin Laden was killed. So as far as the public statement was made, the official statement from the White House was that Adolf Hitler was dead. But there are multiple FBI files that show that there are reports from credible sources around the world citing Hitler, citing Bormann, setting up, what could possibly be a Fourth Reich, the movement of money, the movement of resources. All of these things were well documented, late 40s through the 50s, on even into the early 60s. So the FBI, there is no documentation that shows the FBI ever closed this case and said that, this Hitler is dead, we have definitive proof. As you said, and the picture that's out there that people see of Hitler, that most people think is Hitler's body, is actually from a couple weeks earlier, and it's actually was proven to be one of his body doubles.
Wow. I'm just wowing. I can't help it. I mean, you are absolutely right. And I'm a conspiracy theorist. I'll come right out and say it. I'm a conspiracy guy.
Yeah, he's our Alex Jones.
Which we have made connections between Adolf Hitler and South America. But watching season one and season two and watching your work, you guys are almost able to trek his entire path through Europe to South America. How did it start? I mean, what was the process that you guys took to actually make that entire trek?
Well, and the process is exactly what you see in the Situation Room on the show, is basically, having had all of these documents compiled into a computer database and then looking for specific hits, specific keywords in certain time frames. You can narrow down basically the time frame of Hitler's egress by knowing when the last known sighting of him was that was confirmed to be him. And of course, that was at an awards ceremony in the days leading up to his reported death. So knowing that, and then that would be your starting date point. That was the date that he absolutely positively had to still be in Germany. Then you look for these hits. Where are these sightings? Where does his name come up in communiques from other organizations? Where are their keywords? Where are there some of his surrogates and handlers being cited? What kind of activity was being performed at that time? And we point to one in the second season, what appears to be obvious test flights to get him out, where they're flying people of semi-importance out of Berlin, out of Germany. These have all the appearance of dry runs, that these were the monkeys being shot into space first in order to make sure that it could work before you put the Fuhrer on an aircraft and send him out. And also in the final days of the Third Reich, where was their money going? And we know that the money was leaving. You know, they were shoring up accounts in other countries. You know, people in Spain were getting money. People in South America were getting money. Money was going all over the world because the writing was on the wall. And a lot of high-ranking officials in the Reich were looking for their exit strategy. And every indication says that, of course, Adolf Hitler was one of those. He did not think his time on this earth was over. He thought that he had a destiny to fulfill, whether it was at that time as leader of the Third Reich or later in planning and leading the Fourth Reich. And certainly there's every indication there that the planning was in place, that the mechanisms were in place, and it was at least a possibility.
You know, and that's why I don't find this idea of Hitler escaping Germany so conspiratorial. I mean, there are people that he died, and that's all there is to it. But exactly what you said, and let me amend that a little bit, Mike. You have a man who believed that it was his divine destiny
yes.
to recreate the world in an Aryan fashion. Mm-hmm. He had a cult following. He had a branch of his government that was a cult that studied yes. this.
Yes, he did.
Why would he at the very end, Russia is at your doors. I mean, they are bombing Berlin with artillery. But why would you kill yourself? Why would you not have an exit plan? I will lose this in order to fight another day. I will escape and reestablish somewhere else because it is my divine destiny to do this. Why? And even if without, let's take the divinity out of the question or out of the equation. You have got a man that has absolute power over millions of people, millions of dollars. He's got an incredibly well-working machine when the Third Reich was at its height. Why would you not have an exit plan and a safe house, for lack of better terms?
Not only that, but you look at, this was explored in season one, that there were very few eyewitness reports of people that said, yes, I saw the body. And those that did were very close to Hitler. I mean, they were his inner circle. This wasn't just some low-level soldier, some low-level Nazi official. These were the people who were most loyal to him. And when people cast doubt on whether or not they could be lying about what they saw, look at the terrible things that were carried out in his name that people were willing to carry to their grave. Look at the concentration camps. Look at everything else. These are horrendous things. If people were willing to carry out those absolutely horrendous acts against humanity in the name of this man, why would they not be prepared to sit on the witness stand in Nuremberg and lie and to face the hangman's noose for him? Because as you said, I mean, it's the cult of personality. They worshiped yes. this man. They were willing to die for him, and many thought dying for him is my ticket to Valhalla. This is it. I am going to die in an honorable fashion. There was a film a few years ago that dealt specifically with the Nuremberg trial, and I do not remember who it was, but one of the high-ranking Nazi officials said to one of the American soldiers, he said, "You don't understand, my place in Valhalla is secured because I'm dying with honor and I am loyal to the Fuhrer till the end."
Yeah, it was Goering.
It was Goering, I believe, yes.
Yes. And if nothing else, why not escape purely for criminal reasons? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got inmates in my jail right now smearing themselves with mayonnaise and slipping through air vents to escape. Why would Hitler not go to South America?
Right.
And the Perones, people have to know, I don't think people realize that Evita Peron, and they were very sympathetic to the Nazis. And Argentina had a huge number of Nazis, even more so than probably Germany.
Yes. Yeah, there were huge enclaves in Argentina, and these weren't enclaves that sprang up post World War II. These were enclaves that had roots going back to the early part of the 20th century, and there was one that we visited in Paraguay that had been formed prior to the 1930s. And just to give you an idea, and this much of this didn't make it onto the show, but it's a matter of history, so I can talk about it. This was a colony that was established in a remote area of Paraguay of German expatriates that were still so loyal to the fatherland that when World War II did kick off, many of them who actually had been born in Paraguay, who had never even seen Germany, got on a ship and went across the Atlantic and enlisted because the loyalty, as far as they were concerned, they were still Germans. I visited a German cemetery where there are iron crosses on the gravestones in Paraguay. These are people that are proud to have gone and served, who are proud to have answered the call when Adolf Hitler issued the call worldwide. Certainly these enclaves are places that any Nazi could have sought refuge after the war, and the more high level the Nazi, probably the safer they would have been, i.e. if Adolf Hitler had shown up at someone's doorstep, he would have been welcomed with open arms.
Yeah. And when we had Gerard on, I don't know if you agree with this, but he sort of said that Nazism didn't really end, it just changed. It went from the Nazi uniform to the Hugo Boss suit.
Exactly. There was a recognition that they still felt their ideals were correct, but they also knew that the world had been against them, and that if they wanted to forward their ideals in the form of the Fourth Reich, they were going to have to put a different face on it, and they certainly did.
So where do you think it's all going then, as in Nazism and the Hitler thing and all that? So you think it still exists in this different format, and is there still something to worry about?
I do think it still exists. I think there are people out there that's – I remember hearing a joke about it years ago, the guys who goose-step in their basement, they call them. And honestly, I don't think if you want Mike's opinion on this, I don't think the ones that we have to worry about are the ones who shave their heads and show up at these rallies and burn crosses.
Net Nazis.
I think the real Nazis see them as a nice little diversion. That's the straw man that's going to keep everybody occupied, and everybody's going to continue to believe this is just a little cluster of trailer park living rednecks, and we're just going to ridicule them, and they're not gaining any traction. And although those individuals in their hearts, they probably do think they are real Nazis, they're not as much of a threat. They're never going to change the world. I mean, certainly they do commit crimes against people who they feel are not aligned with them, but they're not the ones bent on world domination. And those people are still out there, and they're wearing different guises, and they have, I am sure, infiltrated higher levels of government around the world and infiltrated Fortune 100 companies around the world. And they're seeking to reach the same goals through different means, through economic means, through legislative means, slowly inching us towards those same ideals. And they're just doing it differently.
So was there anything that you came across that totally blew you out of the water, totally surprised you, that you could have never seen coming during your investigation?
Really, everything that you saw in the finale, if there was one time period that just totally blew me away, it was that I was totally unprepared for what we found at Colonia Dignidad. It was established as a German colony in the late 50s, early 60s. Actually, we ended up uncovering it has a history that goes back a little farther than that. There's actually was a Spanish colony there before that. So there is, you know, we talk a lot about the Spain connection in Europe. There's a Spanish connection to the people that inhabited that property previously, which I thought was a little bit too convenient, you know, to write off as just a coincidence. The fact that, you know, you had Franco in Spain, that area previously controlled by Spanish expats, and then all of a sudden it gets transferred to these German expats that set up this very secure compound for the time that it was established, exceedingly remote, and really total population control. Again, another cult of personality, and the, you know, the leader of that compound just totally holding everybody under his control, literally controlling every waking moment, and just the unspeakable atrocities that occurred there. It really, just literally walking through those buildings, walking around those buildings, and learning what had taken place there, it stood the hairs on the back of my neck up on end just thinking about it.
Could you actually feel it? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
You felt how it, you could just feel the emotion still.
There was it was very disquieting. And, you know, between Tim and I, we have somewhere around 20 combat deployments probably, and I'm estimating. Tim has a few more than I do for the Global War on Terror. I have a few more than Tim does when it comes to drug war type stuff. But certainly we're no stranger to atrocities. Gerard has been in Rwanda. I mean, he's been in some of the worst places in the world. This place just, there was just a feeling about that place that was just really unnerving. And it's, you know, I think if you would have had a psychic walk those same grounds, you know, not, I don't know if I want to delve into that theory too much, but there were some weird mojo there. I mean, that's really the only way that I can put it. It was a very unsettling. It just didn't feel right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's got to be. And you being part of military and being in other areas doing things like that, you certainly can tell the difference, right? So.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you know, everything about that place just felt wrong. You know, it's, you know, what had gone on there, the facade that exists on it today, nothing felt right. It's, there's really no other way that I can describe it.
Yeah, you said the facade existing today. So if someone hadn't seen the show, maybe explain to them what you mean by that.
So basically now it's kind of a weekend destination resort community. I mean, they have a small hotel. They have a restaurant and beer hall. They have an outdoor fest tent pavilion, you know, much like you'd see in Oktoberfest in Germany. They have a Mercedes Unimog truck that drives people on nature tours. They have a small lake with little hydro bikes that you can paddle around. They have various, you know, hiking and biking activities that go on. It's a destination for Chileans to go on weekends. Weddings are held there. We talk about that in the show. When I saw that on the billboard, I was blown away. You know, in arriving there, we knew that the place had a past, and we knew that they, you know, the story we had heard was they were trying to put that past behind them and trying to kind of build from the ashes. But, you know, as opposed to having it be a place where maybe they had, you know, converted it to agriculture and put up a, you know, small museum to the things that had happened, much like a Holocaust museum, to kind of recognize that, it was like you had built a theme park on top of this and completely ignored it. You just, one day it's a torture camp and the next day it's a weekend resort. That discontinuity just totally blew me away. Yeah.
Wow. That's going to be so strange to stay in a place like that where they're dressed up like you say, it's a nice place to come and all the things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they changed the beds.
Yeah, one would hope, right? it does make you wonder if you peeled up the carpet in a couple of those rooms, what you would see. But so much of the stuff is still there. I mean, you guys saw, I'm sure, on the show, where Tim and I uncovered, hydraulic barricades and secret tunnels, and what appeared to be an observation post, or listening position, or even places where people could be thrown in a hole and tortured. It's just really shocking, and we could probably do a whole season just on what went on there. That's there's quite a bit more that didn't make it into the final cut, and for reasons I can't really get into, but there's a lot has gone on there, and I think a lot may still be going on there to some extent.
Well, Mike, what would end this for you? I mean, what would make you think, okay, we have found Hitler. He's right here. This is him. What would it take for that to happen for you?
I don't think I think we would have to end it on the same predication that we started it with, which is, we started it with no DNA evidence. So I think in order for us to put an end, to put a cap on this, we would have to end it with DNA evidence, or either DNA evidence or a proof positive, firsthand account, if possible, with some type of physical evidence to show that he was in a certain location at a certain time. But I'm at the point now, I can't speak for the rest of the investigative team, but to me, that the Holy Grail, not to besmirch the name of the Holy Grail by putting this on parallel, would be to find that DNA evidence, to find Adolf Hitler's ultimate resting place, to exhume that body, to get the proof positive that, no, the body was never in Berlin, it was never in Moscow, it was here, and we found it.
Now, that's a... Oh, I'm sorry, Al, go ahead.
I was just going to say, have you got access to any of his living relatives, Bud?
Yeah, my question, exactly.
Oh, there we go.
Not to put the cart before the horse, but really until we have something to compare it to, and that's not something I've directly inquired. It's something we have talked about on the team. There are aspects of the investigation that have nothing to do with me, and that would be one of them. Trying to get access to people that we can get that evidence from, and there are some living relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Some don't want to be found. There are even a couple people that claim to be living relatives that it's come out that are not living relatives of Adolf Hitler.
Yes.
So, I would leave that to Bob and John, as the heads of this investigation, to find the right person to go out in the field and do that. That's going to be a little bit more talking to people and convincing them to give a blood and or tissue sample, as opposed to my job is a little bit more crawling around in the mud and doing a little hard interrogation on somebody who I think is hiding something to get that information.
Oh, but you Mike, now I'm going to pull the card here. You cannot be that patient. Because in preparation for this show, I also watched a documentary called Meet the Hitlers. Maybe
yes.
You're familiar with it. And how could you not... how can you, Mike, I know your part in the show, but how can you be that patient, having done all that you've done so far, and say, well, I'm just going to leave that to them right there. I'm going to sit over here patiently and wait till it comes to me. I mean, I would have to actively pursue this.
And well, the reason, not to cut you off, but the reason I can be that patient is because of my 32 years in the military, and having been involved in manhunts and investigations before and intelligence gathering, I know that everything has to – you don't want cross-contamination. So everything has to be compartmentalized. And I can't, you know, that's why when Tim's in South America doing his thing and I'm in Europe doing my thing, Tim and I are not communicating about this show. We text an email about UFC and about shooting and stuff like that. But I don't ask him, I don't say, oh, wait, you know, we found this. Wait till you find out about it. Because, you know, there has to be that blind corroboration there. And, you know, I've got my eyes on my portion of the investigation. And if I start reaching outside of my lane, there is the potential that, you know, that I can contaminate another leg, cell of this investigation. And I don't want to do that. You know, that's, yes. You know, the way that I can best serve this team, you know, I answer to Bob and John in the Situation Room, and the best way that I can serve them is I stay in my lane, I keep my eye on my 50 and 150 meter target in front of me, and I report to them. And whenever possible, I try not to make too many judgments about that. And you'll see on camera that I do, but I try not to pass that on in my reporting, because ultimately I need to be passing on raw facts as they're uncovered, not passing them on with Mike's personal conjecture to possibly taint them, because you know, ultimately that decision has to be made at a higher level than myself.
Yeah, you are absolutely right, and I'm kind of ashamed of myself right now.
You shouldn't be.
But that's now, well, let's go back to the DNA, though, because even if we, okay, let's say we have the Hitler family in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and we have their DNA, and you Walmart. Have, probably.
He's the greeter at the door.
Touche. But, and you have a suspect sample, let's say, let's go back to Chile. Where is, do we have an original reference sample from a suspect sample in Berlin? Are you following me, or am I making this clear? Because there has to be a chain from start to finish.
Right. Well, I know, I mean, the jawbone that was in Moscow, that was in a vault for years, they did DNA analysis on. Ultimately, they did determine that it was, in fact, female, and then not to get on too much of a segue, but and probably not Eva Braun, because the skull did have a bullet wound through it, which we know that Eva was never shot through the skull.
And she was poisoned.
She was poisoned with a cyanide capsule, but of course we couldn't test it against Eva's relatives. They didn't want to participate in that. They do have the DNA blueprint from that, and my assumption would be that they did have some DNA, some of Hitler's DNA. You know, he was a famous man. I mean, we have DNA samples from Napoleon. I don't know if people realize that. You know, we have Napoleon's hair. The people that used to cut Napoleon's hair when he was exiled to Elba used to sell his hair.
Yes.
So, which is one of the reasons that we know that he was being slowly poisoned by his staff, but that's another show.
Yes, I have a keychain.
Do you? Yeah.
No, so, I'm just playing.
Oh, I was going to say, I'd like to see it sometime. There's, I'm sure, you know, with that, again, I've been staying in my lane, but my anticipation would have to be that there is some DNA out there that we could do some cross-referencing off of, even without having a living relative. I mean, there's got to be hair samples out there. There's got to be other things out there that we can use.
Now, if I can be the mean one on the show, how is your take on the negative press about hunting Hitler?
I don't pay too much attention to it. I will say this: I noticed right after the show hit, I saw a little bit of a social media burp with some negative comments, and in the irony was that two or three of the people that I saw making those comments were persons who refer to themselves as historians, both in their social media profiles and elsewhere, and were people who tried very, very hard to be a part of this investigative team and were told, quite frankly, they did not have the credentials.
Qualify.
Yeah, they didn't qualify. And I mean, I mean, you look at who we got. We got James Holland. I mean, right. You can't get anybody better than that. So the competition was pretty stiff. You know, we had some very top-notch people to choose from when it came down to make that decision. So a lot of these C-League historians, and I'm making air quotes, who fancy themselves as experts, who were dying to be on the show and then got turned down, some have had some sour grapes, and some have chose to vent that, you know, in the form of, you know, saying disparaging things about this show on social media. And if you look at most of the things they say, most of the things they say are strictly straw man arguments. They're not specifically, I can disprove this or I can disprove that. It's like, oh, you know, you're making conjecture about this. Well, you know, you're making conjecture in what you're stating, you know. And the only source that you're giving to back this up is a book that you contributed to, or, you know, a book that you teach out of at your little community college or whatever it might be. So I don't put, you know, again, having seen that a few of these individuals are people whose resumes I know, and I know why they're doing it, I don't care. Neither the network nor the production company has cared to respond to them because, quite frankly, it's just not worth it. It's, you know, nobody's paying much attention to them anyway, so why should we bother? Yeah. I did see a review of the show that was less than complimentary that I read. And I don't know the name or the website it was on, but I wouldn't give it anyway. But I did get a little bit of enjoyment out of it because it referred to me, not by name, but it described me as a plucky little sewer explorer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which I thought was very endearing. You know, I didn't know at the age of 50 I could still be – I'm 51 now. I just turned 51 this month. I didn't know at the age of 50 I could still be considered plucky, but apparently I can.
That would be a great Twitter name.
Plucky yes. Little sewer explorer. It's a little on the long side, but yeah, it's not bad.
Or .com.
Yeah.
Yeah, luckylittleexplorer.com.
Well, and of course we have to ask you about season 3, and I know that you can't really tell us because it's up to the production company and it's up to history. What's your feeling on doing a season 3? Would you listen to?
I can tell you that there were in the information that we sifted through to do season 2, there were a lot of things there that we never got to run down. Either because we couldn't get access to a location or couldn't get access to a person, or we didn't have time to properly vet a certain person, place, or thing prior to go checking it out, so we didn't want to waste valuable time going to do it and then it not be vetted later on. You know, it's very organic. It is an ongoing investigation, and that was, I think, very evident, especially in season 2. But there's a lot of stuff, you know, when those folders closed, there's a lot of stuff in there we still haven't gotten into. And we're getting more information all the time. You know, that's every time, you know, going places we get information, new people becoming exposed to the show who know somebody or know a thing or have an item or have an uncle, those people are reaching out to us all the time with more information. So the information is definitely there to do a third season. I'm available. I hope it gets done. I want to be a part of it if it does. You know, I've been told by some of my own family members I have a face for radio, so whether or not they want me back, I don't know.
Join the club.
if they do, I'm certainly on board. I'm ready. My bags are packed all the time. My passport is current, and I'm ready to go. So
ready to go.
Now, speaking of face for radio, I understand you have your own show.
I do, Tim. Tim and I actually have a show. I had my own podcast previously that I put on hiatus for a while, and then what ended up happening is Tim and I now have a podcast. It's called The Sheepdog Project. It's available on iTunes, Podbay, Stitcher, if that is still around, I'm not sure, Google Play. And pretty much every other platform, so you can, you know, whether you have an iPhone or an Android, whatever you have. We actually, right out of the gate, we actually shot up to number one in our category on iTunes. We have a lot of very loyal listeners. We have yet to do an episode where we specifically talk too much about the show, although that is upcoming. We talk a lot about mixed martial arts, a lot about firearms, a lot about our experiences in special forces, about what it means to be a modern sheepdog, i.e., you know, a modern warrior in every sense of the word, looking out for yourself, looking out for your family, being prepared, and doing what it takes, you know, physically, mentally, you know, whether it's with your bare hands, with weapons, with survival tools, or with medical gear. We talk about the full spectrum.
Wow. I'm ready. I'm in. I'm going to watch. I'm going to listen.
Yeah, that's. I hope you do. I hope you, you know, again, it's called the Sheepdog Project, and we've had nothing but great feedback from people. I think, you know, if you like the team that Tim and I made on the screen, I think you'll like the team that we make in the studio even better. We try to keep it as laid back as possible and just share our experiences, and, you know, if we can change a few lives along the way, that's our goal.
Well, we'll get that. Actually, we'll link that up to on our website as well, so you can maybe give you a little bit more push.
Great. Love it.
Well, again, thank you very much. Our guest has been Mike Simpson, and he's from Hunting Hitler on History. Thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. I hope if I can do a quick social media plug as well.
Go for it.
Absolutely.
Not too gratuitous. So I'm on both Twitter and Instagram at Dr. Mike Simpson, DrMikeSimpson. And I'm also now have a public Facebook page that's Dr. Mike Simpson, only spelled all the way out. So it's Facebook/ Dr. Mike Simpson. You can also link me through the Sheepdog Response page. I'm a cadre member there, and we're also on Facebook at Facebook/ Sheepdog Response.
Excellent.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Have been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.